Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Myra Kalman is an award-winning artist, illustrator, and product designer, but that also tells you nothing about her because she's someone who's always asking, "Who am I and what do I know?" Yes, she has illustrated numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine, including with Rick Meyerowitz, the New Yorker, the famous New Yorker stand cover, which I'm sure many of you might even have pinned to your walls to this day. And she has written and illustrated more than a dozen children's books. Many of you have read to your children Max in Hollywood, or Swami on Rye, or Next Stop Grand Central Station. Her articles and illustrations have appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, Interview, and many other publications. She's designed products for the Museum of Modern Art under the M & Company label, fabric for Isaac Mizrahi, accessories for Kate Spade, and sets for Mark Morris Dance Group. She's also known for her illustrations, which accompany the iconic English grammar texts, The Elements of Style. And perhaps Myra will tell you tonight how that project came about, if I remember to ask her. Her heartbreakingly beautiful monthly illustrated blog, The Principles of Uncertainty, which she wrote for the New York Times, is now a book. This is something that makes me very, very happy, and I'm sure if you've read it, it makes you very, very happy. And if you haven't read it or seen it, I think you will become very, very happy. Myra's mother's family fled Russia, and my father's family fled Russia, so that is probably why, if you're wondering why me, why I'm interviewing her here tonight. We both also like hats. I'm so glad many of you are wearing one. So without further ado, please welcome Myra Kalman to the Los Angeles Public Library. To take it away for the beginning.
Yeah, and we'll start with something completely not having to do with anything with me at all,
like,
which is a good way to start the evening, I think. Is this too close or too far?
Yeah, that's good.
I don't know how many of you noticed this up on the screen and whether any of you read about this in the paper, but this was you see that there's a vending machine at the end of that photo, but there are two little feet sticking out underneath it. Maybe you've noticed that or you didn't, but it's a Japanese fashion designer who made this outfit for somebody who's running away from muggers, and so that's a big problem, or not a big problem, but she decided it was a problem, and that what you could do is within 10 seconds you could assemble this outfit, I think from a skirt or from a bag, I'm not quite sure what it was, I think from a skirt, and you could actually assemble it and stand there and pretend that you were a vending machine. But the problem is that she said that if you're nervous, if they're chasing you and you're really scared and your hands are shaking, it might take more than 10 seconds, which could be a problem.
Do you think that would work in New York?
Well, I'm going to get an outfit and see and just wear it and see what happens.
Yep.
I mean, you know, who's not going to notice those two little feet sticking out there? But maybe you wouldn't. And then for children, she could turn them into a fire plug.
Well, the shoes should be red, I think, the shoes.
There should be something about not having the shoes there or, like, you know.
Yeah.
But, and if she was wearing, like, Comme des Garçons shoes, they'd be very long and pointy. But anyway, I just thought it was an enchanting way to, you know, that's what you see something like that, and you can't not share it with everybody. So that's the beginning. That's the beginning of our talk, which will lead into misery soon enough. But I brought this image of Ludwig Bemelmans to to talk about what it is to be an illustrator. He was really an inspiration for me, and you know, the Madeline books are amazing. And he wrote for adults and for children. He painted, he traveled, he was a bon vivant, which is the main thrust of what I'd like to be when I when I have a retinue like that. He has a cook, he has a chef, he has a chauffeur, he has a secretary. It's what happens when you're an illustrator. You just go right into the big money. But I have that on my wall, and I always look at him. He looks so happy and so delighted and so full of life and fun. And I had a great meal, so I thought this is a good feeling to this is the feeling to remember when you're working, that there's something there that should always bring some kind of phenomenal delight, no matter how distressing the subject is. That's there are points. But
he would probably make it into the next month, were you to do a 13th month after having done the blog for a year, don't
right.
you think?
Well, I would probably do he lived he was never with his family. I mean, there were some glitches in his personality. He never thought he had to be with his wife and kid, and he lived in like with Elsie DeWolf in some fabulous mansion somewhere. So I probably would do the room they had breakfast in or something like that, or his hat or something like that. So what should I, should we
yeah,
just...
Tell us about the principles of uncertainty. So why don't we start with one of the blogs? How many people here have actually seen it in the New York Times? So we have some initiated and some haven't. So tell us about this book. What is it? What is this book?
I have to say, though, that I'm allergic to the word blog.
Okay.
Because it sounds like barf and blurt.
I agree, but they called it that. They did call it that.
Yeah, yeah. No, but then I would call them and say, could you please just change it to column or memoir or something, or monthly missive. But, because the sense that it was something that was worked on for a while and not just in the heat of, midnight, like my deadline's the next morning, though sometimes I did that. But anyway, so I considered it whatever, some other thing, and maybe they'll change that name. When they asked me to do it, they said, "Just what do you want to write about? What do you want to do?" And I thought, "Well, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'll write about my life." And so, the point of it was to write about my life, which is the nature of living, where I am living. My life. So I, that what happens is that I didn't know what I was going to write about, and I didn't know what was going to interest me, except I know that I'm curious about a lot of things, and a lot of things, break my heart and make me, insanely happy. And this insane,
roller coaster
thing going on.
The roller coaster, that is a theme, definitely. The roller coaster is
roller
a theme.
Coaster.
And also, have you said on other occasions that, you write about how to live and how to die, and it's what you think about all the time.
Right.
So that's all through the column.
Thank you. it's inescapable. And the more, there's the balance of working worrying about all of these things and then forgetting about that and getting down to the business of working. So fortunately, I have a way to forget all the things that I'm thinking about, which is to not think about them and work, which is supposed to be about what I'm thinking about.
Or as Cocteau said, pay attention to your distractions because they are you. And that seems to be a principle that's part of the principles of uncertainty.
Right, right. I mean, and the more I think about it, the less I understand about anything, the more I think about those in moments, in between moments, are the most real things that I could possibly envision, and which doesn't mean that there aren't pragmatic things going on, but that sense of the unknown, of the unsayable, in the the unspeakable or the unutterable,
the off moments, even
the off moments, So, which bring pleasure and terror. So anyway, this is what I ask in the flap of the book. I was asked to write flap copy, and I thought, well, good. So. And even then you think, okay, so there's a book, but you think this is good. No, I'm okay. I'm very happy with having a book. And the first month was called Sorry the Rest Unknown, and it was based on a map it came from a map that my mother had made, and it was a shorter piece, and it starts with the dodo, and it really is about, well, okay, how am I going to start? How am I going to tell you? You know, okay. And so then we have the dodo who died, and then...
But wait, the dodo who died, what made the dodo spring into your mind as the beginning?
Because I had been seeing a lot of dodos in...
You've been seeing a lot of dodos.
And I was worried. No, I had seen a lot of dodos in museums.
I saw
recreations
one,
of dodos,
I
not
saw
the
one
real
too,
thing.
But
know.
But where, like in New York,
in London.
I saw one in Edinburgh, and the museum guard said that his eyes would follow you wherever you walked in the room.
Right,
I remember that.
The powerful dodo. Where else did we see? Let's say London.
So you've
let's
been seeing dodos.
London.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I start. You know, if I see a dodo and it's really fantastic, then I start looking for dodos in books and. Collecting stuff and collecting the artifacts and the ephemera of, you know, the dodoism. And then, you know, and so anyway, they were there and they were eaten. But so, and I said, we don't, so then the dodos were dead. And Spinoza was working at the same time. And Spinoza was trying to figure out the rational explanation for everything, the separation of religion versus rational life. The eudaimonia, the search for happiness, and was excommunicated twice, and from the Jews and from the Christians, and died alone. His last meal was chicken soup, supposedly, but that's what they said in something, and he was an extraordinary human being, and then he died. And so in this thing I say, and I'm talking about Spinoza and about my mother and about what is happiness and what is happiness really, and how do you actually define that, which is completely, absurd and impossible to define unless you feel it when you do. And so I said, then he died, and we don't have a stuffed Spinoza, but we do have a stuffed Pavlov's dog. And when Rick and I went to St. Petersburg, we went to the Museum of Hygiene, which is a must destination for anybody who goes to St. Petersburg. And we didn't have time for anything else, but we went to this place, and there was this stuffed Pavlov's dog with the electrical rump on his behind. How long had he been there? 100 years or something like that? In this crazy palace that was once this fantastic place with this now broken down, nutty museum.
And I just now realized that I was confusing Pavlov's dog with the dog that went up in space. I was going to say 100 years. Right. That was only Sputnik was only 50 years ago, but that dog didn't come back.
He did. Where did he go?
He burned up in space. Oh. Yeah, another sad Russian dog.
What was
dog.
His name?
See, sad Russian dogs. I think it was Laika. Yeah.
Laika?
Yeah. L-A-I-K-A, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the film, My Life is a Dog, the kid is very hung up on Laika, the dog, worrying about the dog. But I would worry about that dog, too. That's so sad.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so there, and these horrible museum guards are guarding this crazy stuffed dog. And anyway, so we were really happy to see that. Really, really happy. And I thought, those are the moments when life is good. So, which led me to... make a chart. You can't see this, but it's a chart of just a few of the people that Stalin got rid of. And I like charts, and I like charts of people that are shot or dead or disappeared. And some of them just have a question mark under them, like they couldn't even possibly begin to tell you what happened to them. It was so horrible. So anyway, and I said, that Stalin, which leads me right to my father. Cheers. That Stalin was a paranoid man, even more than my father, which is really something else. But at any rate...
Do you know that even when he was in prison, he was managing to murder people? Because there's this new biography out of him on young Stalin. He started being bad really young.
Really
young.
Stalin in training.
Yeah, Stalin
in
training.
Yeah, it was really... And the place is so bitter. Just like the legacy of Russia in its phenomenal bitterness and what's happened to the people there, of course. But so, which leads me to Nabokov, whose work I really adore, and whose family had to flee, and which leads me to my mother, and whose family fled, leaving a small village on the River Sluch, which plays prominently in the family's stories, and.
Before you leave the map
is the feature,
which is stuck in my book because it also the book also has a honey cake recipe, and now it is on the map. But this is Myra's mother's map that is in the book. And you suggest that once we detach it, then it becomes something that falls out of a book.
Yeah, you have a choice. You can either put it back in the book, because right. I collect things that fall out of books.
Right.
And you can have your own things that fall out of...
And it does fall out now.
And it does.
Right.
Because they didn't bind it the right way, which is a whole other, you know, story. But so this map, which is too small also, but this map, as you can see, is a map. I asked a bunch of people to make maps of the United States for memory. My mother made this map. You know, I always say to people, if you want to know what I grew up with, this is the kind of person that I lived with, and it's extremely. It wasn't done tongue in cheek. It wasn't. It was. I mean, you know, she put Lenin, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem there. Yes, you know, she knew she was being eccentric. But look where she has California and Texas and South Carolina is on top of North Carolina, and she's got. North Daco. North Daco. How does she even know about North Daco? I mean, she never left New York. She didn't, acknowledge any other existence of any other state in the country.
It also has a feeling sort of the digestive system. Isn't it?
It's just, she's, I don't know.
Is that her line, though? Sorry, the rest unknown?
Yeah, yeah. So then she writes in the middle, sorry, the rest unknown, thank you, which means sorry, the rest unknown, you know, go to hell, I couldn't care less. So that's a good person to grow up with, because you don't have to ever worry about not knowing anything. Right?
But there's she encouraged you to do all sorts of things, right? I mean, she was a great...
Yes. I mean, she was my greatest love and friend and inspiration, and she, you know, the life that we led was this funny life, you know, there were music. And when you look at the culture, it's like we grew up in, you know, we left Israel and I grew up in the Bronx, but it was the Bronx of, you know, high culture and piano lessons and ballet lessons and running to the museums all the time and concerts. And we had a subscription to Realité, Vogue, for the fashion aspect of things, which was sublime, and Life magazine and Reader's Digest for humor is the best medicine. So there was a range of really wonderful stuff coming through that we devoured.
That's wonderful. I thought about your book is dedicated to your mother, to your beautiful mother. And this morning when I was baking the honey cake from your recipe, Anne, my mother, who's no longer with us, was definitely, my husband said, Anne's coming out. She's very manic. I think I'll just stay out of the kitchen for a while.
Is that a good thing? That's
it was wonderful. Yeah. It's like she was just, I was just so excited. I was making the honey cake recipe and I was going to meet you tonight. Yeah. It was like, and it's just this wonderful enthusiasm that she had for life. So I felt like thinking about your mother and through the book, it's like my mother was being, her energy was being summoned
right.
up. Yes.
Right.
So thank you.
So should we go on to the next one or should we talk?
Keep going.
So, you know, one of the New Yorker covers that I did was the Misery Day Parade, because February is so atrocious in New York. I mean, you don't have the same misery in February misery that we do in New York.
Well, we need to hear this because my husband is very interested in moving to the East Coast, but he's never been there in February.
Right.
So
well,
watch
know.
Closely, Lloyd.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's not a pretty picture.
Not a pretty picture.
And so I don't have the cover with me, but in this parade, it's just, you know, what's the point? Because I think I was watching Parade in the City, and I thought, everybody's so cheery, everybody's so, you know, hoo-ha, and I thought, why don't they just have a parade of how we really feel? So it was, you know, the Paralyzed by Panic Brigade and the, you know, what's the point? Division and all, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and everybody is miserably walking down the street, so I thought I would delve into it a little bit more, and didn't really get the guts of February. And so, you know, in the book, I was handwriting in this, you know, so here it is. It's paintings, gouache on paper, handwritten for the internet, and then I'm typing on my typewriter, on brown paper bags that I collect from coffee shops, because you never know, you know, you always need a brown paper bag.
This is the only one, this is the only month, though, that's on brown paper bag. Are there
No, this is the brown paper bag month.
So that was a brown paper, specifically for February. So
and I have pinking shears, and I, you know, well, I didn't know what I would use it for, but, you know, that's the thing, you say, I don't know what I'm going to use these brown paper bags for, but I know that they're going to really be important.
How big is your collection? I mean, how
big? Big. It's a subset of a subset. You know, I have packets. You know, I have bags, packets. You know,
how are they organized?
They're organized very, very neatly in folders and files that go on forever and ever. I have Mickey Rooney's. Well, I have Mickey Rooney's. You know, Weenie World in in the index. There's a really good appendix in this book.
There is a great appendix.
A few little collections that I put in there. I mean, you know. So The Man Dances on Salt is the beginning of something, I don't know what, which leads me to this, this is the pleasure of having a job where everything that you do is your work, and that I went to visit a friend of mine who had this newspaper article with a photo of this writer, Robert Walser, a German newspaper, no, maybe it was a Swiss newspaper. Anyway, it was a newspaper of this guy, Robert Walser, who had died in the snow. And I really fell in love with that photograph. So she sent me, so she made a copy of the paper, and she wrapped it, and she made a box of cookies for me, which she's a really good baker, and wrapped it with this, well, with that, and with beautiful linen.
I get it. That's him.
Yeah.
I did. Okay.
Yeah, that's him. That's the box I got from my friend, and I was, like, ecstatic. I couldn't believe it. And a package arrives wrapped in newspaper and tied with strips of fabric. And the newspaper has a photo of a man. The man is lying in the snow dead. And so here is the man. His hat flew off his head. I hope he is not really dead, just enjoying a refreshing lie down in the snow. But the caption says he is dead. So he's dead. And I couldn't believe he was dead, but he was dead. And so he was a writer, a Swiss writer, who had written a book about a man who was dead. Died in the snow, who was dead in the snow. And then he went crazy, and he was in a mental institution for 30 years. And he wrote another book about, he wrote another book based on his experiences as going to a servant school so he could be a servant in this palace in Germany, which what I'm going to do, I'm going to be a servant for a duchess, the Duchess of Devonshire.
Why not?
Why not?
Why not?
Exactly. Why not? Those are my words indeed. Why not? And I said that, Rick would be the butler. But I said I'm getting some resistance from the butler side of this.
I see. But, So when you come across a figure like this, I mean, the photo itself is a way for you to go into the story.
Yeah.
But then the photo becomes part of your story because your story are these things that you're curious about that then are linking from one to another.
Right.
Because you're turning on a dime, Myra. What happened? And what happens next?
Well, what happened was, so he's still dead. And then I just talk about other things that are sad. You know, the woman leans over in anguish, not about that, but about all sad things. And then about this woman is consoling this young girl with very long hair, and you can just see there's an awful lot of hair to deal with, which... You know, we'll leave that alone. And then the seated man is getting annoyed at the other man for standing too close to him and lying and realizing that lying is it's not possible not to lie, and that is a real exploration of not only not to lie but how can you possibly say what you mean, which obsesses me all the time. And basically, I think better not to talk. And though it's hard, you have to talk, and one wants not to. So this woman, this is Zelda Fitzgerald, and she, the woman stood in front of the tree before she went mad. She wrote a book, and then she went mad. How do you go mad? How do you not go mad? This is the countess who died, and then two sisters, my mother-in-law, and then...
Now we're moving in. Now the frame includes your family. So
right.
So then you're bringing it back into the familial and the personal, and to where your story connects with. So it's connecting up our story with the kind of meta narrative, the one that's going
by
every day in the newspaper so fast that we. Do you know someone said that we read more in one day in the newspaper than in the New York Times than Shakespeare read in his entire life. I mean, it's an incredible. And you're dealing with all of this coming into you all the time.
Right.
So this is you're slowing it down, aren't you?
Well, that's in the ideal world. I'm always trying to figure out how to slow time down. It's really Very true. Mm-hmm. And one way to do that is to either be really bored, which is not that great. You don't want to be bored, but or to go to the country and just look at grass growing. But another way is to really explore that those narrative lines and be very present. Be absolutely in the cliche of being in the moment. If you're in the moment and you insist on being in the moment, that expands time, mm-hmm. and then the things that are really wonderful and very emotionally moving, you have the chance to notice them, and they happen. So, I mean, that's what I hope will happen. Would happen to me that wandering through the world, that there wouldn't be any time when I'm not doing that, because then I get annoyed or I get frustrated or anxious if I'm not feeling that way, which happens anyway. I mean, you can't even. And so I met this monk on the street, and he was wearing this fantastic, fantastic handmade robe.
It is fantastic.
Fantastic. And he handed me a card that said Inner Peace Center, and that, then started the whole thing, like, why does he have more inner peace than me? What about if he met my relatives? Would, he go nuts? What about his relatives? Would they make him nuts? And it's a question that I ask over and over again, who, and then I say in my conclusion is that everybody gets on everybody's nerves.
It's a sad thing.
It's true.
But it's there.
So that question of here you are going through life, you're meeting people, you're doing things, and then you have to accept the fact that sometimes you're going to hate people or hate yourself or whatever. It's a confusing thing. And then I was telling the story that he invited me to a tea ceremony, and I got nervous. I thought maybe he was a maniac who would kill me, who would chop me up into a million little pieces. And then I was saying that I told a friend of mine about this, and she said she thought it was amazing that I thought that the one person who gives me a card that says inner peace, I thought, would want to chop me up into a million pieces. But I meet a million lunatics on the street every day, and it's just like, I love you madly, and so it's,
and
who
you
knows?
And you follow some of them, too, so yes.
Some of them now I'm following to the point where I actually track them down and harass them personally.
But you will actually, like, if someone's walking down the street and they're wearing a pair of wings, you have no compunction about going and asking them, if you could.
Yeah.
But because you have to take their...
Well, they're wearing wings.
They're wearing wings, right. That's
not
true.
Being that anonymous. But no, but it depends. It gets, that's the sense of that you think, okay, you run after somebody and they're wearing wings and you want to just say, you are extraordinary and I love you madly and let me take your picture. I mean, the way that I approach things, and I think that's one of the things about the work, is that I'm never doing it from a cynical point of view. I'm not making fun of people. I'm doing it because I'm really falling in love, 100 times a day. Or my heart is broken 100 times a day. So it's not about, look at you, you're foolish.
And what is the value, what do you think the value is of having a broken heart?
No value at all. It's horrible.
But it's
no, I don't know.
But it's so, it seems so, it's so essential,
it makes you, if you're going to say more compassionate or about other, the story, everybody else's story, or everybody's need for their own story, and that, mm-hmm. and that you'll be compassionate about somebody has religion, let's say, as frightening as it may be, but that kind of thing, or like, let's say that if I found myself all of a sudden becoming like this, religious nut, and then I'd say, okay, that's what I needed. I'm a little bit worried that's going to happen, that I'm going to become completely insane in my last few days, and we were talking about that, Ingmar Bergman said he didn't want to ever be old enough to believe in religion. But then in the end, he...
Did he?
In the end, he believed, this documentary was extraordinary, Bergman's Island, he believed that he was going to be reunited with his wife, who had died before him, and he was madly in love with her. And he couldn't bear the idea of not being with her for eternity. So this completely... this man who lived in his world of rigorous world, all of a sudden made that completely insane leap to thinking that he would be reunited. And so I talk about that too. That sometimes I think, well, why shouldn't you have a cozy feeling that you're going to be reunited with the people that you love?
I know. That's
why not? What's it? Who's it going to hurt?
You have the fluffy clouds.
Fluffy clouds. Yeah. We're fluffy. We're together. We're happy. So that's not good, you know, I don't know. But anyway, I mean, that's a digression, but that sense of, you know, whatever story you need for your own sanity, maybe that's what, I don't know. Anyway. And the contrast here is that in my house, this from after meeting this guy with the zero inner peace, there was, you know, zero, my home, there was zero inner peace at my, you know, in my home. And my parents, I don't think, I think they may have spoken to each other at some point in their 38-year marriage, but I can't recall any conversations whatsoever. It was tense. It was tense. But they had they were very social, which is a crazy contradiction. They constantly had parties. I don't know how they managed to communicate that they were going to have a party, but they did. At any rate, at this party that I'm remembering in the 60s in Riverdale, the cake was, they favored mocha cream cake. And so, and this is the cake. So this mocha cream cake.
You really did it with a mocha cream cake. That was quite good, amazing.
Right?
That's pretty great.
So in the library in New York last week, the text, this, I work with the composer to create three songs using the questions in this book, and Nico Muley was the composer, and he performed in the library in New York, and afterwards the reception was 30 mocha cream cakes that came from from Mother's Bakery in Riverdale, where you know I had to go there and have more meetings with them than I did with the editorial staff of the New York Times working on this. But this is true.
Well, it's great that they were mocha cream cakes and not meatloaf sprinkled with colored cookie crumbs as your aunt made. Is that right?
Yeah. Well,
who sprinkles meatloaf with? I mean, colored. What did it look like?
Horrible. It was a horrible, horrible thing to look at.
I'm so sorry.
And to eat. Can you imagine eating it?
That's really horrible.
So the whole thing was scary. She was a dentist, and she had her dental office in the apartment, and there was like this, you know, like these things, and she came out with this meatloaf with cookies, crumbs. It was crazy.
Let's get by that page. Let's move.
So anyway, so we're you know, so we could, well, we could go, do a little bit more, or
go for it. Let's.
I'm sorry that I keep turning like this, but this is what is this? This fragment, this hard wisp of what? Of darkness of thought or immensity of the universe? Is it a dream, a foreboding? Or does it mean absolutely nothing? I mean, and that's probably one of my earliest...
Do you want to read it from the book?
Oh, okay. My visual... Thank you. My visual sense memories of having that kind of crazy, floating, you know, smallness in immensity. Probably, you know, the same kind of thing that everybody has.
Did your mother ever ask you your dreams? I mean, were they something that dreams are ever discussed in your house? No.
No. We never had any conversations like that.
No.
No, we didn't have conversations. I don't know how to say this, but...
Who were you talking to?
Myself. No, I was really doing a lot of daydreaming. And actually, that's probably why I'm here today, because I daydreamed a tremendous amount, and nobody stopped me.
And where did that daydreaming happen? I mean, were you like...
Mostly in math at school, but I got my best daydreaming then. But, you know, everywhere and allwhere. So I say, you know, that, and I say, well, I cannot ask Freud, and if I could, how could I trust him now that I know of his long affair with his sister-in-law, Minna?
That really is horrible.
Yeah, I don't know if it's horrible, and I don't know what it means, and I don't even know if I agree. I say so patriarchal, I cannot stand it, because, you know, I can't stand patriarchal men.
I mean, it's possible that maybe they carried it on and didn't, and no one really suffered from it.
I don't know.
But it did kind of stop you in your tracks. I mean, when you thought about it.
Yeah, well, because it became this huge uproar in the, you know, psychoanalytic community. What does it mean? Can you believe in him anymore? Can you not believe in him anymore? And I don't know enough about Freud's, you know, about Freud's teachings to know, or his, you know, his work to say definitively, because of course he was a genius and he did a lot of amazing stuff. But, you know, and then you have to say, does one indiscretion, or like a lifetime, you know, the sister-in-law, the sister that lives with them, by the by, you know.
Right.
What is that about? But anyway, I'm not here to judge. I'm stopping to judge things. I mean, you know, that's another thing I could say. So I don't know. That's a good approach. But and what's interesting about that is that he was the proponent of uttering the things that were unutterable.
Right.
And then around the corner, Wittgenstein is saying, after a lifetime of investigation, we cannot ever utter what it is we really want to say. Mm. It is unsayable. Mm. And so it's an incredible, you know, way to observe, you know, and then everybody does what they do. So anyway, he designed a house for his sister, and this is the radiator. He was, you know, phenomenally.
What drew you to the radiator?
Well, he designed every little bit of the house, every lock, every.
So he designed.
He designed one house in his life, and
so
it was for his sister.
So he designed the radiator.
Yeah, he designed every single thing.
Let's get that
straight.
He designed the radiator.
Yeah. He had every single thing in the house custom made. And everything was mathematically precise because he was a mathematician, and it was really about this kind of construct. And I like radiators very, very much. And you know, it's just the nature of this. I like interiors from sumptuous places to stark corners.
Yes, because there's both the tassels and the, what do you call the puffs on the bed? Those incredible Viennese. Things
oh
that
my
look
God!
Like
well, they're the pillows. I don't know what they're called. The Schlafzimmer has
the Schlafzimmer,
those
yeah,
phenomenal.
You'll have to see them in the book. They're unbelievable.
And anyway, I talk a little bit about hermits and a little bit about I met the head of the philosophy department at Columbia, who teaches a course on vagueness. But you know what it is? It's not what you think it is. It's about mathematics. I want to take the course. I want to audit the course, and they laughed and laughed and laughed. But he was one of the people that I pursued and harassed until he finally met me for a coffee at this Viennese place up near Columbia.
The
Metropole. And so he was actually phenomenal to talk to because what he said was, I was asking him all of these esoteric questions, the meaning of life, the meaning of this, the meaning of that, and he said, you can't ask those kind of questions. I'm not a guru. I am a man who can answer pragmatic, I can answer real questions, you know, like that can be quantifiable. And on that level, it made me think, and he was eating this crepe with whipped cream at the same time, and it was really very moving, and because he had a stomach ache, and I thought, well, here he is. He's not trying to find out the meaning of life. Forget about it. That's absurd. So I was very happy, and from that moment, I decided no more thinking. From that very moment. And my life really changed. My life really changed. Because you really don't have to think so much. Well, we went to the opera, and there was this fantastic woman there, and this gigantic woman wearing, you know, this dress and teeny heels, and the opera was Eugene Onegin, and Pushkin wrote about in the opera Onegin kills his friend Lenski over some idiotic thing, and in real life Pushkin died in a duel because he thought his wife was having an affair with some baron. Anyway, so the nature of the disjointedness of what's going on here, you know, I had a rationale, but it eludes me now. But at any rate, this is Walter Benjamin, and he's working on his book, and he fled the Nazis, and then
and he's very, actually very important to your work. I don't know if you ever read his essay, The Storyteller.
No.
He says that, and I think it's really what you do, that essentially what, because you've said that you don't like plot. You're kind of suspicious of plot and stories. Is that correct?
Right.
Because he says, I mean, it's really what the storyteller's main job is to remind us of our mortality. And I think you do that so beautifully all through the book. I mean, that's really the essential task of the storyteller. And mm-hmm. and that's really, I think, so much of the, I mean, that wonderful roller coaster of your you know, figuring out how to live and how to die that goes through every page of the book is really very much in his ethos. So he is, there's more Benjamin
right,
in that.
Than I even realized, right. I'm
perhaps so,
I was
yeah.
more superficial about it than, or less, I don't know which. But it's something to think about.
Or not thinking about. Right.
No, I really mean it about not thinking. It's so refreshing. So, oh, I know why. because my friend Richard Devereaux told me about to read about the book, but then he also took me to visit Helen Levitt. And Helen Levitt, who was a wonderful photographer, and this is a wooden camera that Saul Steinberg made for her.
It's just
a sculpture.
Wow.
And you know, he's a great inspiration also. I mean, in many ways, in narrative art and in understanding how to combine words and an image. And Steinberg was really, you know, a complete genius in that.
And she's part of your investigation, really, in how does one age gracefully, right? I mean, you went and visited a number of older artists, asking that question to yourself, and she was one of them. So did she give you inspiration on that score?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what luck plays into all of this, but it must, because some people are amazing and some, you know, and look amazing, and you just want to look at them forever, and some people not, you know. So she was one of those. She was just like this amazing woman and very strong, and isn't photographed, but is still involved, but not taking any more pictures. And in this bathroom of hers, and she lives in a fifth floor walk up, you know, 97 years old in the village. And
she go out and come in. I mean,
she goes out and she comes in, and slowly, but she does, and connected with people. So you know, but also kind of a bitter woman and a feisty woman. And now, you know, I went and looked at her bathroom. I photograph a lot of sinks and bathtubs, and I don't know. I'm drawn to places where people wash their hands and. She, you know, used to print her photos in that bathtub, and now she, you know, hangs her socks there. So you don't know what's going to happen to you. And I went to visit Kitty Carlisle Hart, and she was, you know, she had this, you know, fabulous apartment.
Tell people, does everyone know who Kitty Carlisle Hart is?
So she sang, and it was extraordinary. And she said, she said that she woke up every morning, forgave herself, and then went on with her day, which is a very good. Very good thing to think, anyway. So, and you know, and then I investigate bobby pins. And this woman, I mean, this woman, for instance, walking down the street, I said, oh my God, this woman is stunning. And she had this gigantic, superior bobby pins in her hair. And I thought, you know, she had maybe six, but I only show three. And there are other bobby pin things. And how did I jump to that? I don't know, but at any rate,
and we'll never know.
No. There was a reason, but you know, one of the you know, from going from the moment of a bobby pin to seeing this photo of the Blitz in 1940 in London, and seeing that this is after the people came out of this library was bombed, and then people are there in the room, reading, coming out of the, you know, all clear, and just standing there browsing. It's, you know, really extraordinary. So this photo, which I wanted to go into the elements of style actually, but didn't make it in. The painting of it made it to the book, and you know what happens is that a lot of the things that I see are photographs that I want to use to paint. So here, this is a Robert Polidori painting of a Robert Polidori photograph of New Orleans, and I'm ending. This was March, and we had gone through February and March in New York, and we were coming to this first bit of air in, you know, spring in the air. So I say, you know, spring is in the air, that after all of this heartache, you know, I say, oh my God, the trees are beginning to bud, and the first exhilarating feelings of spring. And that's a Cartier-Bresson photo that is one of my favorites. It's a birthday party by the Seine, and I love painting it, and I paint it in different ways, and I've added my children in there and other things, but that to me is the sense of the perfect moment that describes what I want life to be. That kind of, everybody's doing something different, and everybody's busy, and everybody's in this kind of wonderful dappled light, and they've come from some kind of lunch, and they're going to go somewhere else later, so nobody's bored, and that's a good way to be. And in the end, you know, you buy a nice hat, and that's it. And then you keep calm and carry on.
That's great.
That's.
Now there's this wonderful quote, I think it's from Gertrude Stein, where she says, the daily miracle, it does come. And I know there's times in the books you describe this being in this malaise. I think there's this wonderful part when you're in Paris and you're in the grip of the bad, is that the dream about the poodle that bit you?
Yeah, the bad dream.
But I mean, that sense of that something that will happen in the day that you know, kind of sets it right and that we come to again and again. Do you have that feeling of the kind of daily miracle? Are you kind of looking for that daily miracle?
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's always there. It's, you know, and whatever it is, usually the more minute it is, you know, the more minute the thing is, the more of the miracle that it is.
And even in the most humdrum kind of day, I mean, I remember...
Especially,
one really needs them. My husband came back this morning from going off to some errand, you know, and he was going to have to go off and do the errands. But he came back, he was so excited because he'd seen, I think it was at 12th and Pico, 12th and Berendo, he'd seen a yard with a rooster and chickens, and he was just...
Oh, like live, real ones?
Yeah. And he stopped and he talked to the chickens and to the guy who had the chickens, and he was so happy.
It was
really good. And it's not as... I mean, your book has many sadnesses in it. The chapter in when you visit family in Israel during the war was particularly poignant. You're going and imploring your parents. They're both buried in Israel? Is that right?
Yes. Not near each other. By the way. It's funny. Yeah, it's a riot. But yeah, but same cemetery, but way separate places.
That's funny because in the vault in Hollywood where my parents and my grandparents and cousins are buried, my mother wanted to be on a different floor than her mother-in-law. She said one lifetime was enough.
Right, yes. Like, you know, with all due respect.
With all due respect. Yeah. I know you've been driving around L.A. for the past couple of days. You and Rick have been here. What has caught your attention? What have you stopped to photograph or marvel over in your wanderings? Has there been anything in particular that's...
Well, you know, the architecture of all of it, you know, everywhere is amazing. And then, the tree, maybe somebody knows the name of it, the tree that has the spiky, spiky bark...
I think it's
like a pink floss or a pink fluff.
It's a floss tree, right?
Is it floss?
Silk floss.
Silk floss?
Kapok.
What?
It's kapok.
It's a kapok tree?
Yeah, and it's what they stuff zafus with.
They stuff what?
You know, meditation pillows traditionally were filled with kapok, and that's the tree.
Wait, but what is it that they...
The fiber in the pod that bursts open.
Kapok.
Kapok, yeah.
Kapok.
Exactly.
It's going to be an opera soon, right? It'll definitely be in the opera.
Right.
But you know, I grew up near Kapok Street in Riverdale, but I don't remember those flowers. You took those pink flowers.
Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah. Okay. Any
so that's
sofas?
One of the things. But we saw a few discarded sofas, but mostly, you know, walking around Beverly Hills and looking at all of the topiary and stuff. It's just too fabulous.
I should explain also before we open up why there's a wonderful honey cake recipe in Myra's book in the back, which can be yours. Only you probably want to put a little less baking powder in it.
There's a typo. Right? There's a big typo. I said like you know, half a pound of baking powder, but I guess that's
it's
wrong.
A little. We've got to put it a little late. Yeah, but I think I've got it right now. So, and also I was inspired. I love that. Do you collect things that fall out of books? Maricela, who's here, is a poet, also had a wonderful exhibition where she showed things that she'd collected that had fallen out of books. But you sent me around my house looking at things that had fallen out of books. So I found there was a Polish postcard that fell out of one book, a first issue, First Man on the Moon, First Day of Issue. I hadn't seen that in years. Man's First Landing on the Moon.
Wow.
It's and I hadn't seen
thing.
That. I mean, it was stuck
in... So somebody send that to somebody? That was a real
I mean, I stuck
postcard.
It in a book at some point. I don't know. 1969, September 9th, 1969. And then this other little book that had a note from someone that had later committed suicide. It was the, you know, he gave me this book, you know...
How do you know?
I mean, I know he's died.
You knew, right?
Yeah, but I mean, just... I mean, these are my books, but you're even talking about anonymous books and things that fall.
Yeah.
But
if you go to a bookstore... And you just go, you know, and then you can kind of take the thing.
Right.
Because it's not the book. They don't know, you know.
Right.
Depends.
So it's one of your collections, right? Exactly.
It's not stealing, exactly. Yeah, but, no, well, but you
I'm
also
sure
buy the book. But
some of you have questions for Myra, so we will up the lights a little bit, and Justin has the microphone. So I think there's a woman back there in a hat.
No questions?
There's two women back there in the hat, so one first and then the other.
First of all, why did you seduce us all to wear a hat, and you didn't?
Yeah, well, look at that. I see how many hats there
are. That hat was
a great
photograph of you in that hat,
in
and
that
it
hat.
Looks very chic.
Yeah, that's. I knit that hat myself, actually.
You're like going out without clothes on? I mean, we took a big leap for you.
Uh-oh,
a
wait
big
a minute.
Leap.
What did I do? No,
well, you
I
didn't do
know.
Anything. I just
know.
Invited
right.
people to wear hats because I thought you would wear a hat.
Uh-huh.
So I made an assumption.
No, I said that I'm much more, you know, I wear like...
She turns out, like, as it turns
you know,
out.
Only black clothes and, you know...
I didn't know.
Nothing.
I didn't know. Over here?
No, there's just one more thing.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
One more thing I'd like you to know is that those trees that you like so well, the native parrots eat them.
I'm sorry,
the
I didn't...
Native parrots,
native,
those trees.
We have a lot of parrots that have gone native here in California. And that tree is one of their favorite things to eat.
Parrots?
Yeah,
parrots.
We have feral parrots that have. No, they're wonderful. And you parrots. Walk around and you hear there are flocks of parrots in L.A.
Really?
And they
color
love.
What are they?
They're green, mainly the green.
The green,
green
so they
conures,
look like a parrot.
I think. Cherry-headed conures.
No, they made me feel like they look like rats or something.
No,
but they look like
they're
parrots.
So beautiful. They're beautiful.
Really?
Yeah. And they chatter like
you
monkeys.
You say feral in a way that makes me kind of nervous. I'm scared to walk down the street now.
How about over there?
Feral.
I hope you won't be disappointed that this is not a comment on parrots, but rather on your Max books.
Uh-huh.
They were a great bonding book between I have much younger sisters when I was a teenager, and they were really little girls, and we used to read them together. And one of the great joys of those books is the level of absurdity with them. And I was wondering if you ever felt inhibited, you know, were you ever critiqued that it was too outlandish, or was that sense of silliness encouraged?
By
the editors, by the people as you were creating the books,
oh,
or
no,
with
no.
yourself? Did you edit yourself in any way?
No, I mean, I go through a lot of edits of a book and write it and, you know, and rewrite it, but I would only encourage more absurdity, not less. And there was never any, you know, I mean, sometimes I meet people who say, oh, you know, are you sure the books are for kids? And maybe that's the question that's being asked, but, you know, I kind of ignore that. That's... I would imagine, you know, it's like saying there's too much absurd stuff in a, you know, Marx Brothers movie or something. I mean, I would hope that there would be a parallel of that. Like, of course, there's only absurd stuff. So, otherwise, it wouldn't be my book. It would be somebody else, you know.
Hmm. When you write, do you have a different approach when you're writing for children than you do for adults, or is it pretty much you're just speaking? I mean, it's just in your voice. I mean, do you go about it in a completely different way?
Well, I realize I don't speak about death as much for children. I stay away from the death thing, and it bursts out, and then repressing it for so many years that it just bursts out on every page in my work for adults. But I mean, I couldn't put it in the Elements of Style, except I had a little bit of death in the Elements of Style with that dead body in the middle
right.
of the living room. But that was kind of more British and murder mystery than actual horrible, you know, we're going to die. But
tell us how the Elements of Style came about. It's a. I mean, how you happened to decide or to do it, or what were you asked to do it?
Well, it started when I never went to school when I was in college as an English major, and never. Use the book, so I didn't have any bad memories or bad associations with it. And I found it in a yard sale and picked it up, and I said, my God, this book is crazy, nutty, funny. I wonder if anybody else, you know, knows about it. I mean, of course, I knew that it was Strunk and White, and I knew that it was popular, but I didn't really understand how popular it was. And I said, oh, I'm gonna illustrate this book, and it was completely clear that I would. And then contacted the estate, you know, Martha White, his granddaughter, and they said fine, and
I wonder what E.B. White would have thought.
Well, I met her, and she came for the opera that we did, The Elements of Style, the opera.
This is the granddaughter.
The granddaughter, yeah. Martha, came to New York and said, and it was fantastic. And she wrote about it in a book now of his letters that he would have loved it. We're speaking for somebody who wasn't around, but she said he had a tremendous sense of humor, which of course is why I was attracted to the book. I mean, it's not a deadly book by any means.
No.
And even though I didn't understand most of the rules, that doesn't make any
You'd
difference.
Certainly illustrated well. Another question from the audience. How about right here? Yeah.
What is it with the embroidery?
I'm sorry?
The embroidery.
You talk about your embroidery that's in the book.
Right.
Could you say a few words about your embroidery?
Sure. Well, I went to a psychic community upstate New York, Lilydale, with some friends, as a lark. And I went to, and you go to like these different cabins and you have readings with different people. And then one of them at the end said to me something. She said, all this stuff. And they said, you know what? You can't cry over spilt milk. And I thought, wow, that's really, man, that is something I would never have thought of in my whole life. So I sewed it, and I started writing the cliches that I heard people, and I like to sew, and, in my family, women embroider and sit by the fire and in England and needlepoint, but at any rate, and then I started doing larger panels and then the ultimate one for me was the four panel, the Goethe quote from Faust, I feel a sense of dread. I mean, when I read that, I said, now I'm home, so. Yeah, well, yeah, a lot of people are, actually, the work now, if anybody's going to New York, is going to be in the Museum of Art and Design in New York.
Okay.
It's called Pricked, which is kind of an unfortunate name, Extreme Sewing. I think it's called Extreme Sewing. And there are a lot of people that are doing all kinds of things.
Do you do it on a snowboard?
They don't mean to be funny with this, yeah. On
okay.
a snowboard?
Well, it was just extreme sewing. I was just trying to imagine.
Sewing.
I know, but like barreling down a mountain, on a snowboard, like while you're snowing.
Extreme.
Is there another question? How about over here?
I'm just wondering, with your work, if you think visually first or if you think picture first. What happens in the process in terms of creating a book or creating a theme for the day?
Good question.
It's the nice thing is that it's one big mess, and which I have to kind of sort out. But there are things that I see that are unbelievable and visually phenomenal, and there's writing that I'm thinking about, and it goes back and forth, and I clearly don't want to only do one thing, and I get bored. And one of the things about the sewing was that I was sewing in between painting the elements of style. That was my cool down. That was my kind of in between. I don't like to not do stuff, but that was a way to do stuff in between the other stuff that I was focusing on. So it was the antidote in a way. But it's the same thing as right. I don't want to be limited to do one thing. Thus the column becomes a book, which becomes an opera. And so it's the same thing. I want to have everything influence everything, and then actually it would be nice if everything ended up as music, but that's another road.
I don't think you don't talk a lot about music in the book, in the principles.
Yeah, it's funny.
I was thinking about that in terms of a score for sounds, but I did, the word forbidden word, the B word, your column. But one thing that was so interesting about that form was that we were scrolling down,
right.
And I thought you used that just so beautifully. I mean it was really a different experience than the book is. I mean it was it's really its own form, and I thought you were very adventurous with that form and what it could do on the screen, because I don't really like reading things on the computer screen, and I loved reading that. And obviously many people did, because I don't know if you saw it when it was online, but hundreds and hundreds of people would write in. The one time I wrote in, I mean, it was like within moments there were, and people were so moved by it. I mean, you really touched people in so far-flung places, which, does it make you want to work in that form again?
No. No, it's really funny. Not at all. And I don't even know. I know, and it's. I would like to go back and maybe do films, you know, and do the column as a, you know, I don't know what, but I'm reluctant to. It was really such a beautiful year and such a perfect, in a way, really so perfect for me, with all the stuff that was going on that I can't imagine doing it again. But who knows? I don't know. We'll see.
One more question from the woman in the hat.
Was there any record made of the piece that you did at the library?
Yeah. There's actually a CD of it, which hopefully will be out. There were some like rights, you know, estate rights issues that had to be clarified, but I think it'll probably be out this in the coming year.
Great.
Which will be under, I think it'll be called, Nico. You know, if you look for Nico Muhly's work, Muhly, he's really amazing. And he has a CD of other things, but I think that that'll be available at some point.
Okay. And then the other part of my question was, I just was curious about whether that was a collaboration that you did with Mark Morris on the sets, or just what that was like working on that project.
It was pretty straightforward. You know, I had wanted to do a lot of things. I had a lot of ideas, which, you know, I wanted to do the costumes, and I think I wanted to do some of the dancing, which he kind of like smack me down on. No, and actually, I'm not kidding. But the nice thing is that he did this workshop with us one night,
a bunch
of designers, and gave us this movement to do that was really wonderful. It was you know, he didn't expect us to be doing actual dancing, but we did a kind of conceptual movement thing with him. So he's great. I mean, he's, you know, brilliant and crazy and funny and mean and, you know, all those things. But he wasn't mean to me, so that's good. But it was wonderful.
So, Myra, I have one last question for you, which is, would you like some honey cake?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. You. We'll meet you in the lobby.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.